book of Deuteronomy is composed of the farewell sermons of Moses. He was a miracle child who was drawn out of the Nile River by the princess of Egypt. He was an anointed prophet who spent the first 40 years of his life being educated in the palaces of Egypt. He was the renegade who spent the second 40 years chasing sheep and goats around the wilderness of Midian. And he was the profoundly humble servant of Yahweh who spent the final 40 years of his life leading the stubborn and dissatisfied people of God out from the region of his first home through that of his second. Now he assembles the children of the chosen people of God on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and he gives them their marching orders. It is time for them to inhabit the land of God's patriarchal promises. It is time for them to become the human interface between the singular God of the universe and the rest of the inhabited planet. But the call of God upon their lives to service and maintain the meeting place of Yahweh will demand that they live in dangerously close proximity to the consuming fire of His holiness. And frankly, their inability to maintain the fidelity that is required of them is pretty much taken for granted before they've even begun. Nevertheless, God commanded it, and so Moses explains it. If God already knows that the gracious gift of His covenant will not be cherished by them, why does He persist in it? What is to be gained by the lived reality of their stiff-necked infidelity? If God is that holy, and if He demands that much, then what is it going to take for Him to finally redeem for Himself a people that are His very own, eager to do what is good? In the words of Titus 2:14. The ultimate point, in other words, of the book of Deuteronomy is to demonstrate how impossibly high the bar of reconciliation between Yahweh and His sinful human creatures really is. The ultimate point of Deuteronomy is to point us towards the final and the perfect solution. A quick review of the first 10 chapters of Deuteronomy sets the stage for chapter 11. Moses' first sermon covered the first four chapters. It was an introductory retrospective, a call to get ready for the monumental challenge of a lifetime, a call to move in and settle down in the land of God's fiery, jealous, and gracious, compassionate presence. In chapter one, he began with an attempt, a retrospective of the attempt to first cross the river and of the failure that ensued. He then rehearsed the 38 years leading up to the defeat of Sihon and the defeat of Og, the command to distribute the Transjordan among the three tribes that wanted to stay on the eastern side. And he reviewed the fact that it would be Joshua, not Moses, that would lead them across the river now. The first sermon was a call to remember and obey, to remember a fiery mountain, a formless voice, and a holy, gracious God forming for Himself a singular people. The second sermon, of which chapter 11 is the conclusion, began in chapter 5, with the breathtaking reminiscences of Moses' encounter with Yahweh on the mountain. That day, God handed him the 10 words of life, handwritten by the very finger of God in the original but already broken pair of stone tablets. He remembered the blazing fire, the shattering thunder, and the paradoxically formless but palpable voice of God. And he remembers that these things have proven far more enduring than any of the concrete artifacts that are contained in the covenant box or housed in the sacred tent of meeting the Levites are charged with carrying around the wilderness. Hear His voice above all others in your heart of hearts, Moses says. Love His character and His determinations with all your soul. Remember His unseen presence in every circumstance of your experience. Chapter 5, the 10 words of God, the commands, the decrees, and judgments that will help them to keep those words. Hear God, love God, remember God, chapter 6 states. But Moses knows that our ears grow forgetful, our hearts grow deaf, and our memories get quickly distorted. Moving forward is essential, but it is for people like these impossibly dangerous. So in the next three chapters, Moses staples three most wanted posters to the town hall's public announcements bulletin board. Public enemy number one, syncretism. You're going to be tempted to fit in and mix yourselves and your lives with the people around you. You're going to be tempted to try to have God and the best practices of the others around you. Public enemy number two, materialism. God's going to bless you, and you're going to be tempted to enjoy the blessings more than the God who gave them. Public enemy number three, self-righteousness. God's going to bless you. You're going to settle down. Life's going to be good, and the devil's going to start to make you think that it's because you deserve it. Three most wanted dangers, chapter 7, chapter 8. And chapter 9. And that brought Moses in chapter 10 to return from the perimeter of these external threats to the inner core of spiritual vitality. Like the proverbial perfect front lawn that just needs to have well-fed and well-watered grass in order to keep the seeds and roots of dandelions from taking hold, the human soul needs most to stay deeply rooted in the beauty, truth, and goodness of God's incomparable presence. Do that, and we'll become immune to the clever lies of our short-lived substitutes. Chapter 10, it's all about Yahweh, more than about the symbols or the means or the methods of Yahweh's religion. He's a person. Love him. And so we come to chapter 11. And we are turning to the conclusion of Moses' second sermon. It's a big picture, motivational kind of speech. It's all about the foundations and the core interpretive principles of life intended to exemplify those 10 words of God. There are two ways to approach the task, Moses seems to be saying. On the one hand, you can focus on the perimeter, protecting the boundaries of your promised land. In which case, you will claim its prerogatives and jealously try to hold on to them for yourselves. You will apply all the familiar techniques of survival that you have learned and developed over the years. But choose this way, and you will gradually feel it all slipping away. The tighter you grip it, the faster you'll displace it. This is God's land you're moving into, and it functions according to his radically other ways, not your own intuitive ways. And so, if you're humble and teachable and faithful, you'll take the alternative approach, in which case you'll interpret what your eyes see, what your hands are grasping, and where your feet are taking you, according to the counterintuitive vision of faith. You'll look at mountains and valleys that seem impossible to cultivate, and you'll know that in the land of God's presence, propagation and irrigation are executed on the basis of his promise long before they fall subject to your best efforts. The fruitful farmer or successful vintner in God's land, who begins to sense stressful conditions among the crops, will know that here the solution is not an upgrade to the irrigation system, any more than it is a desperate, half-accusing, and quite possibly half-hearted call for communal prayer. The kind of prayer that is more like signing a petition and trying to stir God up to fix what we think is wrong with his actions than the kind of prayer that falls down before him and invites him to show us what's wrong with our souls. In the land of God's presence, blessing is contingent on the absolute fidelity of our hearts. Here the concerned farmer knows that the wilting crop is crying out for a day of prayer and fasting and a rooting out of those first otherwise unsuspected weeds of self-reliance, self-importance, and self-indulgence. So chapter 11 is all about Yahweh's blessing, and how Yahweh's blessing begins in the midst, at the core, in the heart. And Yahweh's blessing moves out from there, And the extremities, the benefits, the consequences are just symptoms of the inner health. This, I believe, is the necessary interpretive grid with which to reread and hear again, probably for the first time, this second sermon of Moses. It was preached in the 15th century before Christ, on the cusp of entering into the covenant presence of God. If we are serious about moving forward and growing up into the call of God in Christ that he has placed on our lives, then we too need to learn the difference between the blessed way and the cursed way. The blessed way is the way of desiring that God use us as the means of accomplishing his ends. The cursed ways are all the alternative subtleties we use because we are ultimately scheming to use God as the means of accomplishing our ends. In his conclusion to a really insightful discussion of what it would mean to live a more fruitful Christian life, you'll find this in chapter 28 of a little book called Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul, originally written in 1745 by Philip Doddridge. Doddridge writes out an example of the kind of prayer that we've been talking about here. And one of its most memorable sentences, Doddridge breathes out the request, "Make me, I beseech you, a faithful steward for my great Lord. And may I think of no separate interest of my own in opposition to yours." That, I think, captures well the substance of this 11th chapter of Deuteronomy.